This program is a production of WAMC News. From Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly half-hour review of New York State government and politics. Your host is political scientist and syndicated columnist Dr. Alan Shartok of the State University.
In this edition of the Legislative Gazette, we'll look into some of the complex insurance issues in New York State. As you know, Republican Party Chairman George Clark has decided not to run for another term in the party's upcoming election. This week, the field of candidates to succeed Clark narrowed to one. Bill Gralty reports.
It came down to a two-man race. Westchester County Republican Chairman Anthony Colavita and his Erie County counterpart Victor Farley. Colavita had the obvious edge in garnering endorsements from other county leaders all across the state, including quite a few upstate. But Farley hung in until the leaders in the Republican strongholds of Suffolk and Nassau counties indicated they would side with Colavita. Observers credit former Assembly Minority Leader and gubernatorial candidate Jim Emery with bolstering Colavita's upstate fortunes. An aide to Farley says Emery got his field organization revved up on Colavita's behalf, and Farley was just unable to match it. At this point, Colavita's election is now a foregone conclusion, and next month he will formally succeed George Clark, who decided not to seek another term. A spokesman for Colavita told me that he would have no formal statements on party policy until after his election. But Colavita did tell reporters, major tasks ahead include coming up with a candidate to oppose Governor Mario Cuomo. He added it will be difficult against the popular incumbent. Another major challenge will be Republican Senator Alphonse D'Amato's expected re-election campaign. He is certain to face tough Democratic opposition. And, of course, there's the state Senate, where the GOP is trying to protect its majority, and the Assembly, where it is a minority, hoping to close the gap with the Democrats. Those who are looking down the road a bit to the 1988 presidential election have seen signs that it had an impact on the choice of party chairman. One line of thinking had Farley's candidacy serving as a testing ground for Congressman Jack Kemp, a potential presidential contender. Farley, who is close to Kemp, denied that in letters to party officials earlier this month. And there is, at this point, no doubt Colavita will become involved in politics on the presidential level as well, but there are more immediate tasks at hand. And Alan?
Also this week, the head of the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, Lee Thomas, toured the Adirondack region to observe damage from acid rain.
Flying over them, you really get a sense of how widespread the problem is in this area. I've been briefed on it, and I've read about it, but there's no match for coming out and seeing it and hearing the people who are actually working with the problem.
But those words were not enough for Assembly Environment Committee Chairman Maurice Hinchey, who spoke with Bill Gralty.
Despite the fact that he said he was dismayed, he could see no action being taken by the administration or the EPA to confront this problem, which is, I mean, it's really shocking that the EPA administrator can see the damage right up close, firsthand. He took a helicopter ride over the Adirondacks, and he could see the extensive damage to evergreen trees, particularly in the high peak areas. In spite of having that visual proof, that ocular proof right in front of them, they are not going to take any decisive action. We must continue to dramatize this problem and present it in as dramatic fashion as we can so that we can continue to put pressure on the administration and get public opinion to try to move them.
Is it the administration or Congress right now that really needs more of a push?
Well, I think it's the administration. Congress has had several bills that have been introduced. If they had some support from the administration, those bills could have been passed. The administration continues to take the position that not enough is known about the problem of acid rain, in spite of the fact that we've had more than a decade of study of the problem here in this country. And there have been additional decades of study that have been done by a number of the Western European countries. So it's not that we don't know enough about the problem. We certainly do. It's just that the administration is not willing to deal with it.
And you have a gift that you're sending to Washington?
I have two bottles of genuine vintage acid rain, 1985. And the label says that each vintage year guaranteed stronger than the previous. It's a quality import, and this product contains sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides in quantities approved by the United States EPA. And the back label says American Smokestack, a genuine 1985 vintage acid rain from New York State. Not less than 80% of its ingredients have been imported from outside the state, and it's not recommended for extended use. This is the anniversary of a gift I sent to Washington just almost exactly a year ago. A year ago, I sent a small spruce tree and a jug of acid rain. And the message was that if you apply the acid rain to the small spruce tree, you can see the visual effects that acid rain is having on forest products, forest trees in general in the Northeast.
Assemblyman Maurice Hinchy. Now some thoughts from regular contributor Gerald Benjamin. Jerry's a professor of political science and a Republican county legislator from Ulster County.
Can a lawyer be a good secretary? In late July, Governor Mario Cuomo, a lawyer, chose Gerald Crotty, a lawyer, to be his secretary, or top staff aide. Crotty had served as an assistant counsel under Governor Hugh Carey, and as first assistant and then counsel in the current administration. Normally, given the suzerainty of attorneys at all levels of American government and politics, his appointment to the secretaryship would have been unexceptional. But the secretary's position has not been filled by a lawyer since Robert Douglas, a protege of Nelson Rockefeller and also a former counsel, held it briefly in 1971. And it would take a real New York government buff to recall the last sustained service in the secretaryship by a lawyer over a quarter century ago, when Jonathan Bingham served Governor Averell Harriman in the post. What difference does it make? Perhaps the problem, or potential problem, was identified by the governor early in his term when he described himself, an ex-professor of legal writing, as a lawyer, a nitpicker, a footnote writer. Would a lawyer, and especially an ex-legislative counsel like Gerald Crotty, long accustomed to examining the detail of bills for potential snares and pitfalls, be able to see the big picture? Would he be able, in addition, to be the ramrod for policy development, coordination, and implementation that the state bureaucracy has come to expect from the likes of such secretaries as Bill Ronan, Al Marshall, Barb Morgado, and Mike Del Judice? Crotty himself seemed somewhat concerned about this when he commented in the press about his new role. I'm at home as a lawyer, but I can't keep thinking that way. Another aspect of the problem is the balance among top executive chamber aides and their relationship to the governor. In the traditional triumvirate, the secretary developed policy, the council turned policy into concrete legislation, and the budget director was the no man, guarding the fiscal door. Under Nelson Rockefeller, the secretary became dominant, and with him the policy development function. In fact, this activity became so important that ultimately the job was divided, with day-to-day coordination given to the newly created Office of Director of State Operations. Concomitantly, the influence of budget declined, only to resurge with the election of Governor Carey and the emergence of the fiscal crisis. Even under Carey, however, the secretary's position remained the key staff job on the second floor of the Capitol. Carey's second secretary, Bob Morgado, became so powerful that he came to be known in Albany as the governor's governor. Under Cuomo, all this was supposed to change. His spokes of the wheel, hands-on approach to management, the governor said, would give several different aides equal access to him, and as a consequence, he personally would control decision-making. My style is to be eclectic, to use as much talent as I can, Cuomo said. That's much harder than using a single person. But with the Crotty appointment, the governor seems to have acknowledged the need for a single person, other than himself, in a coordinative role in the executive chamber. Cuomo didn't object to the widespread characterization in the press of both his former secretary and his new appointee as a chief of staff, for example, a description that he resisted during his first months in office. Thus, it seems, Cuomo's notions of proper staff organization have evolved to an acceptance of a more hierarchical form, a development many insiders in previous administrations predicted would become irresistible as the governor became more comfortable with his role as chief executive and the demands of the job. And if Mario Cuomo, a lawyer, could take this major step back from detail after adjusting to the governorship, could not Jerry Crotty, his counsel, do the same after a time in his new job? The governor's experience tells him that the answer to this question is a very definite yes.
To many of us, insurance is one of life's necessary evils, something to be left to the friendly insurance agent to handle and then forgotten. But in recent months, insurance has burst onto the front pages with a medical malpractice insurance crisis, problems with towns getting adequate coverage, and several other issues. I spoke about them with Insurance Superintendent James Corcoran.
Superintendent, why do they call you a superintendent and not a commissioner?
Oh, it's just tradition. I always thought it was because superintendents were supposed to be smarter than commissioners, but they tell me that's not true, so I don't know. There are two of us, so...
Superintendent of Banking and the Superintendent of Insurance.
But also the state trooper is a superintendent.
Now, a superintendent has a connotation to it, which is that you oversee, as opposed to commission, I suppose. Is there that? In other words, do we expect you to look into the way in which insurance companies are practicing?
Well, just by coincidence, this is the 125th anniversary of the New York State Insurance Department, and is regarded probably in the world as the leading insurance regulator in the country, if not the world. And that is our job. We oversee the financial viability of these companies, how to behave in the marketplace. Our basic function is financial, of course, to make sure that the money's there when people submit claims and that there's fair competition, but as well as we call market conduct examination, the way they treat people is another criteria we use when we examine these companies. So, yes, we do. We are overseeing, and that's our function.
Now, we have heard a lot, of course, about insurance crises on virtually every setting, in every setting. And that leads me to ask you whether this is a media phenomenon, whether it's real, these crises that we're seeing. For example, we heard a lot about herpes. Now we don't hear that anymore. Is insurance something that's just gotten hot for some unexplainable reason?
I don't know if insurance is analogous to herpes, but... The area of insurance is a very serious concern of the property casualty, not the life insurance area, which is doing fine. The property casualty, we see an awful disruption in the marketplace. And it's our position as a regulator that the behavior of the industry for the last, I'd say, 8 years in very low premium structures has hurt themselves at a point now where some of them, their financial condition is not what we regard as the best.
What led to that, Commissioner? In other words, what did they do that was wrong that led to that?
Well, they went in there, and they were hoping that their investment income would offset their losses in premium underwriting. What they were doing was they were charging too little. Now, that, of course, the consumer says, that's great. You know, they charge too little. But if you're charging too little and the losses are coming in, eventually the financial stability of the company is shaken.
Is that going to be a product of deregulation? In other words, as we deregulate...
There was no prior approval of many of these lines as far as their rates go. It was open competition. Mm-hmm. I had no authority to make them charge more, but we do have the authority through looking at their financial condition to say, look, your reserves are inadequate, and you have to charge more, or you have to stop writing this line of business, that type of... But, of course, that's draconian. You don't want to be putting companies out of business because then you add to the capacity problem. But since I've been in office now, we've taken on quite a few companies because of their financial condition. And what happens is the capacity shrinks in the marketplace, the laws of supply and demand trigger, and premiums go up. What you have now is a slingshot effect. They've held premiums back too long, and now we're seeing incredible 400, 500, and sometimes 1,000% increases in some lines of insurance. And this department is not sitting by idly and watching this, so we're testing the companies to find out, is it justified, what occurred. The companies are clamoring for tort reform. Tort reform is a reality. When anyone with common sense looks at the newspapers and sees it's a kind of a lottery mentality regarding judgments, that's a serious social
meaning
problem.
That they pay astronomical amounts. And we are, I think, compared to the Japanese, which we are just took a look at, we are a nation that loves to sue.
Well, that's no doubt about it. There's some we can all sit here and tell funny stories about ludicrous judgments. There was a recent case in another state which impacted a homeowner's policy where I think they were talking about herpes. A woman contacted herpes, and there was a published settlement of $25,000 on a homeowner's policy. Now, all these things, when I'm sure when the underwriter underwrote that policy, he had no idea that was that exposure he was exposing the company to. That's a small case, but there are an awful lot of horror stories like that We have to bring stability to the marketplace again. We have to at least let them underwrite and know what their exposures are.
But is there a sky on this? In other words, municipalities are literally being forced into semi-bankruptcy at this stage because their insurance is costing them so much, because everybody's suing for potholes and they're suing for road signs that are down or trees that come down. How do we protect ourselves against the cost of insurance?
Well, we have to take a serious and critical look at the tort system. The idea of joint several liability that impacts municipalities directly, in the sense that you might have a drunken driver who hits a pothole, which is a nominal contributor to the accident, and he in fact then kills somebody. Well, he doesn't have much, so they sue the municipality, and that becomes a big pocket theory. We've seen that throughout the state of New York, and municipal liability insurance is no doubt a crisis right now.
So what's the answer?
The answer is we have to take a serious look at tort reform. We also have to look at the insurance system and the behavior of the marketplace, the companies. Now, I can criticize the companies for what they've done, but that doesn't help, doesn't solve it. I mean, you know, just who did it is fine. Here we are today now. What do we have? We have to have a serious look at the tort system, the recovery system. The company stopped underwriting. Years ago, we used to have risk management, and in fact, the insurance industry developed a non-exploding boiler, the safe elevator, all to protect themselves.
Right.
And they stopped doing that. They stopped really being involved in risk management and underwriting. We have to get them back into that business.
But when you know, Superintendent, you keep talking about tort reform. I think that's something that no matter how many times we try to explain it, people don't understand what that is. But again, what is a tort?
Well, it's a wrong in which there might be a liability, keeping it simplistic, and the right to recovery. Now, I am not one who believes that every wrong, every injury, has a recovery under law. We've had some very creative lawyers out there. We live in a very densely populated areas of the state. People bump into each other every day. We have to realize that if you get injured, it's fortuitous in many situations, and you can't sue. And then we've had an awful lot of creative lawyering going on out there, and it's been very disruptive. All that capital being taken out of the mainstream of the economy, 30% of the malpractice rate increases that we had to give represented defense counsel costs or defense and plaintiff counsel costs. So for every $1 paid out, 30 cents represent defense counsel costs.
Something to a lawyer.
Sure. And even in the frivolous cases that have no merit, you still have to defend. The governor has addressed this in the medical malpractice situation. We're aiming at frivolous lawsuits. We're studying it further. The governor's acknowledged that this is the first reasonable step. And medical malice. But medical malice, the beginning, the tip of the iceberg, there's a lot more under it. And we have to make, and the governor's studying it right now, a decision regarding total tort reform.
Okay.
As opposed not to just medical malice.
Okay, now that's fine. When I interviewed a number of assembly Democrats, Jim, there was a reaction about this total tort reform, about looking at a different approach. And when I explored a little bit further, what I was beginning to hear was that there are some things like, for example, the requirement that certain sums of money be kept on hand, which you mentioned before, anticipating payouts, and that sometimes that those requests were unreasonable. Do you see that there's a push on to allow the insurance companies, for example, to have more latitude in where they invest their money and how much they keep on hand? Are you sensing that that's coming down the line?
Well, we have liberalized what the companies can invest in, the life insurance companies. We're looking at liberalizing their investment portfolio, property casualty companies, but you know, that's not the answer at all. That's kind of a distraction, in my own opinion. The companies are not saying they want to invest in other things. They need liquidity to pay claims. We have also a number of major insolvencies here. What happens when the money's not there?
Precisely.
And it's all well and good that we should say, oh, well, let's take a chance. I have no business letting companies take a chance, because the person that gets hurt, that money's not there, the people of the state.
Okay, now here comes the key question.
What a key one.
You said you've looked at, you're looking into tort reform. You say this needs more study, but it looks pretty hopeless to me.
No, nothing. That's why we met with, matter of fact, Vince Teasy and myself have been talking about this extensively, you know, and on economic development, because it relates to the ability of businesses to function. It's a national problem. We have to do is like anything else. Make a good case, articulate it before the legislature. The governor's aware of it. We've written a number of comprehensive memos, which he's read and commented on.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing's hopeless. We will address it. We will make our case. It's a heavy case to make. It's not going to be easy, but it's necessary. And I think the public knows it's necessary.
And among those solutions in your case would be?
Well, you'd have to look at the question of joint. Let's approach the problems. The easiest one that the public can understand is municipal liability. Now, why should a small town, which has, you know, coverages, have to pay for some minor negligence on their part when the major part of it was due to an act of someone passing through our DWI situation?
Oh, so that could be addressed in law, right?
In law. You could change a joint and several rules so that it's not
But the lawyers in the legislature might not like that because, in effect, if the drunk driver can't pay it, then somehow he's not going to get his third.
Well, the legal profession is a very honorable profession. They're there for the public interest. I don't think that you can say that the entire bar would oppose this. There are reasonable people on both sides. The various lawyers associations throughout the state understand the economics of the situation. It has gotten very close to the point where you might be killing the golden goose. There might be no insurance out there.
Do they ever know that?
I think they're aware. They're very clever and smart group of people, and they're socially conscious. They do perform a very valid function in society. They do hold people accountable for their wrongs.
No question.
And if they were not there, many people would not be getting what is just. If someone is the victim of gross negligence, massive malpractice, you just can't say, well, society can't afford to take care of you. You have to provide a mechanism. Now, you've got to provide an efficient mechanism. On the other hand, if someone is slightly injured due to an accident that was really not grossly negligence, and that, you know, and you have many claims of mental distress and all these, you know, some of the more creative things that sometimes are questionable to some of us, you've got to kind of look at that separately.
So it's all a question of where you draw the lines, and you're going to help them draw the lines.
Well, we're going to try to define for the industry, as far as the insurance industry, what their parameters, their exposures to liability are, so they know what they're underwriting. That'll help. That'll help. Right now they feel that it's wide open. That'll bring some stability, and that's the thrust. As far as the public goes, it doesn't help the public to have to wait 9 years for recovery. If someone is injured, they should be getting their money. Justice delayed is just no justice whatsoever. And so we have to change, maybe look at the court system to expedite these things and get rid of the frivolous lawsuits, perhaps penalize lawyers who, as a matter of course, start frivolous strike suits in cases that are found to have no merit whatsoever. Start hitting them, as the governor has in the malpractice bill, to say they could be hit with costs up to $10,000.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing. We wouldn't be sitting in office if we say something was not able to be solved. That's what we're here for, and we try. And it's our job to make a case and to pull the facts together and go forward.
Superintendent James Corcoran.
Well, one thing is for sure, insurance is on everyone's lips. Everyone who owns a home, drives a car, everyone who pays taxes, everyone who needs the services of a doctor knows that the price of insurance has gone through the roof. And whose fault is it? Well, no one seems to know for sure. Superintendent of Insurance Corcoran seems to have given us some clues. Partially, some of the blame has to be placed at the door of the attorneys who are proliferating in number and initiative throughout the country. Many of these people do a very good job of informing people of their, quote, options, unquote. And the lawyers take a nice hunk out of every settlement, often a third. Corcoran gives us the absolutely astounding fact that out of every dollar paid by an insurance company, a third goes to the lawyer. On the other hand, if someone is hurt by a town which hasn't fixed a pothole, if a doctor has taken the wrong leg off or removed a part of someone's brain when they were supposed to be working on their sinus, the question can be appropriately asked, doesn't the person have the right to sue and doesn't the insurance company have the obligation to pay off? And of course, there are some other interesting questions. For example, as deregulation of the insurance industry sets in, as the insurance companies go head-to-head lowering their rates all the while, who will protect them from themselves so there's enough in the till to pay off? And an awful lot of people are also asking whether the dramatic rise in insurance rates for cities and towns as well as for doctors isn't some kind of a sucker deal akin to the so-called oil crisis of a few years ago, which now seems to have been contrived, to say the least. It may well be that it isn't, but in this business, perception is a big part of the game. Finally comes the question, can we as a society afford all of this? Will we have to limit the fees that lawyers charge even further? Perhaps if the rewards aren't as great, the incentives to get people to sue on the lawyer's part will be fewer. Perhaps if we begin to punish people for bringing frivolous lawsuits by fining them, maybe then their initiative will be lessened. Perhaps we will have to draw lines about how much can be recovered so that juries do not find themselves making excessive awards that we all have to pay for through increased premiums. Perhaps we will have to redefine what constitutes a wrong in the first place. All of this, of course, is complicated by the fact that the legislature, particularly the Assembly, is loaded with lawyers. No matter what the superintendent of insurance says about killing the golden goose, these lawyers show little sign of understanding the dimensions of the insurance crisis we're in. But sometimes, unfortunately, things have to get very bad before the public awakens from its usual stupor and insists that something be done. They've done it before, and they'll do it again. That's our show for this week. Join us again next week for another look at state government and politics. Bill Gralty edits and produces this program. Please address comments and questions to us at WAMC Box 13,000, Albany, New York, 12212. I'm Alan Chartok.
The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC News. Alan Chartok is executive producer. This program is made possible with funds provided by the State University of New York College at New Paltz.